This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
And welcome to the PeopleSpeakRadio.net. This is David Swanson, your host, and we are privileged to have with us for the next 45 minutes or so a veteran of our occupation of Iraq and now a leading member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, Adam Kokesh. Adam, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
We've got a somewhat limited format, 45 minutes, and I want to focus on the testimony that you gave at the Winter Soldier events recently, but just the background, I've heard you say and read that you you believed some of the lies about the weapons of mass destruction and the ties to 9/11, and yet you still thought it was going to be a bad idea to invade Iraq. Is that correct?
Well, you know, forgive me for having gone through what I've gone and still being someone who believes in the rule of law and has always believed in America first and foremost honoring its word. And as it says in the Constitution itself, all treaties that we ratify become paramount equivalent to the highest law of the land and carry the full authority of the Constitution. And by that alone, as a Marine, as someone who believed in the rule of law, I thought that it was a bad idea.
Fair enough. And then after the invasion had occurred, my understanding is that you believed, as many people still believe today, some of the lies about the occupation and about the so-called reconstruction, and so you actually volunteered to go over there. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I really bought the storyline. I mean, it took me going to Iraq and seeing so blatantly for myself how much of a divide and a gap there was between the rhetoric being used to justify the occupation and the reality on the ground and being slapped in the face with just, bam, how much we've been lied to repeatedly, to really realize that and to go back and question, you know, really everything and realize that, you know, when it's absurd that we as activists are questioning on our credibility when this administration has lied to us, you know, over 935 times, at least that we know about. But I really believe the storyline, which was that what we were doing was cleaning up our mess and responsible foreign policy and trying to do good by the Iraqi people. And as a Marine who actually joined the Marines because, you know, aside from patriotism, that I thought that the Marines had a net positive effect on the world. You know, it was more by our presence than by our actions, but like I really believed that. And then given the chance to serve as a Marine doing something as noble as rebuilding a country, you know, and helping the people on such a massive scale as it was being sold to us, that concept, like, I was all about it. I loved it. I was like, it was the thing I was most gung-ho about in my entire Marine career. I was a reservist. I was going to college. I knew that they were looking for volunteers. My unit wasn't going. I dropped out of college before I knew that I was going to Iraq. I dropped out of college because I knew that if one way or another, if I showed up at Camp Pendleton and said, I'm going to Iraq, I'm a ready, willing, and capable Marine, I'm going to Iraq, that they would send me. I dropped out of college not knowing where I was going to go, what unit I was going with, any of that. I dropped out of college, and I said, this is something that is worth risking my life for. I enthusiastically risked my life for this lie. And, you know, to come home and see this, to stop and go, holy crap. Like, you know, from my experience, like it really took my experience to get me to come to that realization. But, you know, like having served in civil affairs, which is what I volunteered for, which I was really excited about. I mean, I would have gone with any unit, but to go with civil affairs, to be like the tip of the spear rebuilding Iraq, like, you know, that was something I was really excited about. And then,
What is that for us civilians, Adam? For us civilians, can you explain what civil affairs means to be a Marine working on civil affairs?
Well, in a sense, you know, we really are the bastard child of the military. Civil affairs, you know, the Army has civil affairs units, the Marine Corps has civil affairs units. And our job, by the definition, is to do everything that is the interface between the civilian population and the military in a war zone. And I think by the doctrine, the way it's put it is, to ensure that the civilians do not interfere with military operations, to ensure that military operations do not interfere with civilian life, and that if possible, civilian activities support military operations. But in Iraq, that has become shaking hands, kissing babies, and the majority of what we were doing in terms of early rebuilding was distributing money to Iraqi contractors for small local projects.
Huh. Yeah, it seems a little out of place to have a special civil affairs section when what we're talking about is an occupation of a civilian population by a military.
I thought like the entire military could be civil affairs, you know, and when I went to Iraq, I really thought that that we were going to be attached to grunt units, to infantry, like we knew that because that was like the military structure and the command and how they were managing areas of responsibility. But, you know, I had this crazy fantasy based on that story that we were all told, based on the rhetoric that the president was using to justify the occupation at that point, that the military structure, that those infantry units there would be there to support us in civil affairs, that after the invasion we would become the tip of the spear. And that wasn't the case. Not by a long shot.
Now, when you worked over there, I know from some of your testimony that you spoke a little bit of Arabic. Did you learn that over there, or did you know something about Arabic
before? I was so excited about my job and what we were going to be doing and the fact that I was going to have the opportunity to interact with the Iraqi people. It was just, to me, it was like, aside from being a great learning experience, I was like, well, you know, I'll be a better Marine if I teach myself Arabic. So I went out of my way, you know. My going away present by my request from my little brother was teach yourself Arabic, a little book and a translation dictionary. And so, you know, I started teaching myself. And then when I got there, I started working with the translators that we had access to at night. And I learned enough Arabic to say, you know, Arid Atamrin Arabi, you know, I want to practice my Arabic with you. And they were all about it, and they were really excited to see that there were Americans there that really did care about that.
Well, I want to talk in particular about what you testified about at the Winter Soldier hearings, which, by the way, people can go and watch at ivaw.org. But I want to let people know that they can get in on this conversation with Adam Kokesh, who is a leader in Iraq Veterans Against the War, and you can call in toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. and Canada at 888-228-4494, and Adam will be happy to take your questions, 888-228-4494, or from anywhere else in the world, including Iraq, at 877-489-6350. That's 877-489-6350. Adam, you were there in the area of Fallujah at the time of the first siege of Fallujah by the U.S. military, and when you began describing what went on in your testimony at the recent Winter Soldier events, you said, "I think it's criminal to put people in a situation where their morals are at odds with their survival instincts." What did you mean by that?
Well, we have these rules of engagement, and when I went to Iraq, they actually issued us these little plastic cards called your ROE cards, and we were supposed to carry them in our left breast pocket the whole time that we were in country, and I don't know anybody who did. I think I tried to, but it was a laminated piece of paper that wasn't even cut to square. And so these rules of engagement say that you're allowed to use, the first line of the card is, nothing on this card prevents you from using deadly force to defend yourself. And then it talks about when it's appropriate to use deadly force and escalation of force in different situations. And, you know, one of the things is that before you ever engage a target, you have to have positive identification, which is to say reasonable certainty that your target is a legitimate military target. Now, when you get shot at from a building and you're in a civilian area that's populated with Iraqi civilians, and you're just driving the convoy down the street and you get shot at from a building, and you keep getting shot at from that building, and you don't see anything. You might see at most a muzzle flash, you know, and you there's no way that you could look through a sight of any weapon and see what is defined as a legitimate military target, and yet you keep getting shot at from this building. Your survival instincts tell you that if you return fire towards that muzzle flash or into that building, you will be more likely to survive. And yet, by the rules of engagement card, you're not supposed to. But then it says, nothing prevents you from using deadly force to defend yourself. So what should you even do? And you're put in that situation where your morals, where you're thinking, you know, I don't want to shoot into a building full of civilians. Because we are, you know, all American soldiers in Iraq are essentially moral human beings. And you don't want to do that. But you're trained and you're conditioned in such a way that, you know, it's also, you also have survival instincts that are very keen there. And it's like, it's either you or them. And, you know, when you don't believe in the mission, even, and you're there, and your only mission that you've assigned yourself is to come home alive, and to make sure that all the Marines in your squad come home alive, that takes precedence. And it's criminal to put someone in that situation. Someone who has simply put on the uniform to serve their country, who has sworn an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, to say, all right, make this choice. You know, that's criminal. To knowingly and deliberately, repeatedly put people in that situation is criminal. And that's just the start of it with rules of engagement. We change rules of engagement all the time. So at one point, a legitimate military target became anyone in the city of Fallujah after dark who was moving. Then it became any suspicious-looking observer. So someone who was looking at you from a rooftop with a cell phone could be a suspicious observer. Someone with binoculars becomes a suspicious observer. And you're told by your command when they change those rules of engagement that you have reasonable certainty that those things are legitimate military targets. And that's almost never the case.
And so there was
a really poignant example that I talked about in my testimony was during the siege of Fallujah. There was we were dropping T-130 gunship, Spectre gunship rounds, 105mm howitzer rounds into the city, and there was a fire. And this was when we were told, shoot anything that moves after dark. We have reasonable certainty that those are legitimate military targets, that they're insurgents, they're enemies, they're terrorists, what have you. And so firefighters and policemen came to put out this fire, and they were silhouetted against it, and the Marines there shot at them because they were told by their command, those are legitimate military targets.
And they knew that they were rescue workers and firemen?
No, that's the thing, is that the Marines firing couldn't know. The Marines firing saw silhouettes against the fire, and their orders were, shoot anything that moves after dark in the city of Fallujah, because we have reasonable certainty that those are enemy targets, that those are legitimate military targets.
Because you had imposed a curfew, Adam, correct? The United States military
exactly.
Had imposed a curfew on Fallujah.
We turned Fallujah into a penitentiary.
Yeah. And so here you have a case of us starting a fire with rounds shot from an airplane, and when firemen go to put out the fire, they're shot at.
Exactly.
And presumably there are cases where people learn after the fact that they just shot a fireman. I mean,
right.
How do people deal with the thought?
I don't know, and I hope that those Marines forever remain blissfully ignorant. I really do. I can't imagine. I was really fortunate when I was in Iraq. I never had to make the decision. I never had to pull the trigger. Every time that I was getting shot at personally, I was either driving or behind somebody. You know, I had a couple of close calls. I had a couple of bullets, embed themselves in my Humvee in interesting places and bounce off my door. And we took a lot of indirect fire, but, you know, I never had to make that decision. But, you know, what we did as civil affairs, we were a fig leaf. You know, we were there to cover up the crime that is this occupation. That, you know, we were there to put a nice gloss over the true motive of why we're there. To say, yeah, we're really helping people. But I know that as much good as we were doing on a small local level in civil affairs, that it was futile in the larger picture of the occupation. That, you know, security and rule of law will never be established under this occupation that I was a part of. And, you know, I get a really sick feeling in my stomach, at least, every time that I think that I enthusiastically risk my life for a lot. I mean, that's, that's the extent of the guttural emotions that I have connected to this. But, I mean, I can't imagine
much
for the guys that know that they did kill innocent civilians. And I have friends that I know have gone through that. And, you know, it's mind-boggling that they can, you know, get over that, but they do.
Yeah, there's a young vet in Vermont who tells a story of holding up a fist as a military signal to stop, which the driver interprets as a sign of solidarity and keeps driving, and they shoot up a family in a car. And there's a similar story that you told in your testimony at Winter Soldier, and you showed photos of a car that had been shot up. And your remarks there and in a couple other cases suggested that maybe your views have changed somewhat from the time you were there to the present day, in that you had a photo of yourself posing with the car, and you said that what felt strange about it was not the immorality of having shot up the people in this car, but posing with it when it wasn't your kill.
Yeah,
have your views evolved from the time you were there to now?
Well, maybe I should step back for a second.
Sure.
You know, let a few thoughts in my own head unscrew themselves, but to explain to your listeners that in the story there was a Iraqi that was killed at a checkpoint with a 50 caliber machine gun. His vehicle caught on fire, and after it was done burning, was dragged into the compound where we were sleeping during the siege of Fallujah. And it just so happened, by some sick inside joke that we ended up nicknaming him Crispy Johnny. And we all took turns sitting on the hood posing with him. And you know, I don't want to incriminate anyone else, but there was a group of us, and it was totally normal.
Sure.
But at the time, it was like, you know, everybody wanted to have that trophy picture. Everybody wanted to say, like, you know, we were part of this killing of the enemy. You know, we were there. Like, it, you know, it's a trophy picture. I mean, it's really, you know, I mean, I don't know if it's ever, like, morally justified, but it's a pretty typical feature of people in the military, or people in war, rather, that they, you know, that the ultimate achievement is to face your enemy and kill them and not be killed yourself. And to,
right,
to want to celebrate that when it happens. And that we're so desperate to have that moment, you know, that we'll pose with a dead guy who we didn't even kill, to say we were a part of this effort. You know, we were there. We were there when another Marine, at least, you know, looked the enemy in the eye and killed him. And, you know, we have no reason to believe that this particular guy was guilty of anything other than driving too fast on his way home.
Right.
You know, and
I just have the impression, Adam, that if you were dropped back into that moment tomorrow, you might not be eager to take your picture with that car. Maybe I'm wrong.
Dan, if I was dropped into that moment tomorrow, I would throw down my rifle and demand to go home.
Yeah. And it would be a hard fight, but if everyone did that, it'd be a different world. There was another story you told at the Winter Soldier event about during this siege of Fallujah, letting women and children leave, and that at the time you thought this was a very noble and gracious thing to do, and only at some point later did you really think about the choice they were having to make to leave husbands and older sons behind, and how horrific this was to impose on these people. What was your thinking at the time and then now?
Well, I think one of the premises to that attitude is what I would call the new American arrogance. I know it's nothing new, but you know the form that it takes today is somewhat new, and it's just that core belief that America can do no wrong, and we are infallible in our foreign policy, and that the Iraqi people should be grateful to have Americans patrolling their streets. And I felt that, like I really, believed in at least some of that, and that, you know, we were there to fix Iraq, that like we could tell them how their country should be put back together better than they could do it for themselves. Like, you know, I maybe with never having said it, like I totally believed in that premise.
So if America is always right and America is letting women and children leave, that must be the right thing to do, right?
Well, you know, I mean, for us, when I was there and it was like, all right, we got the city under siege, you know, and our job in civil affairs is to make sure that, you know, not as many civilians get killed in the process, or that we distribute humanitarian rations to some of those outside the city, you know, if the good graces of our command say that, well, we're going to let this many more civilians live today. Hey, that's awesome. Great. We are the most generous people on the planet. You know, we must be so nice and kind. And, you know, so for me, like, that was the attitude. Like, once you really, when you're there, you're in that situation, you're looking at it through that lens, and you accept that premise of, or those premises of this American arrogance, then, you know, any act of mercy or generosity seems like a great thing. Like, you know, if you take a detainee who's been, you know, sleep deprived for, you know, a week because you've been blaring Metallica in his ear, and you turn it off for an hour. Well, you're a really nice guy because you turn the music off for an hour, you know. And, you know, even if you keep them awake, you know, and that's just how backwards this attitude is. You know, like once you accept such a massive faulty premise, this is like, this kind of thing is inevitable, and this is why, you know, we describe, you know, and I talk about my testimony, you know, as the inevitable result of occupation policy. It, you know, no one should be surprised at what's going on in Iraq right now, really, you know?
Yeah, it's so everything's sort of in relative terms, the way the surge is a success because the violence is a little less horrific than it was the month before. We have a caller on the line I want to get to before we have to take a quick break. Steve from Santa Fe.
I think that's a really good point, though, that just the acceptance that the surge is working means you have to totally accept that premise of the new American arrogance.
I think that's right. Let's bring a caller in on the conversation quickly. Steve from Santa Fe, you're on the People Speak Radio with Adam Kokesh.
Thank you for taking my call. And Adam, I don't really have a question. I just wanted to thank you for your patriotism and welcome you back home. But, you know, you have a big, huge support base of veterans from all different wars that look at your telling the truth and coming up as being true patriotism. And thank you.
Are you a veteran, sir?
Yes, I am a combat veteran from Vietnam.
Are you a member of Veterans for Peace?
Pardon me?
Are you a member of Veterans for Peace?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay.
I also work through the veterans system with the Vietnam veterans for Peace. Thank you.
Awesome. I'm from Santa Fe myself, and every time I go back, you know, I try to do something with the Veterans for Peace chapter there. It's a
right,
great
but,
activist.
My name's Steve Dees. I'll leave it at the Vet Center, and we'll have to have coffee.
Absolutely. Well, please send me an email, too, so I can get your contact info for anybody else. Especially
okay.
From Santa Fe, it's adam@igaw.org.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Glad we could make that connection. If you didn't hear, if you want to email Adam Kokesh, you can do so at adam@ivaw.org. And if you want to see his testimony and all of the testimony from the Winter Soldier events, go to ivaw.org. This is the People Speak Radio, and we are taking your calls, and we will be back for another 20 minutes. And you can call in toll-free from anywhere in the U.S. and Canada at 888-228-4494, 888-228-4494, or anywhere else in the world, 877-489-6350. We have to take a break, and we will be back with Adam Kokesh right after this.
According to polls, a majority of Americans support the impeachment of Dick Cheney. To make people aware of this, the Honk to Impeach campaign has been organized. People will be carrying Honk to Impeach signs in front of congressional district offices and TV and radio stations. Visit ImpeachSpace.com and ImpeachCheney.org for updates of this effort. And don't forget to honk for impeachment.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
This land is.
Join us on the People Speak Radio Show every Tuesday and Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern for an hour of live interview and audience interaction with guests from the realms of entertainment, education, activism, spirituality, politics, and literature. Get involved and make a difference for the better. That's the People Speak every Tuesday and Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio Network.
Maybe you're me.
More than 1 million children are forced into prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. The economic difficulties contribute to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime, to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit SOSMorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
And we are back. This is David Swanson at the People Speak Radio, and our guest for the next 15 or 20 minutes, as long as we can keep him, is Adam Kokesh, one of the leading members of Iraq Veterans Against the War. And Adam, I want to talk about some of the activism you've been involved with since you got back, including right now at the moment. But I did have another question about your testimony at Winter Soldier. You described an incident of detaining some people simply because they had a bag of cash, and that some interrogators came in and began roughing them up, after which it was determined they'd done nothing wrong and they were allowed to go. Can you just describe that, and who are the interrogators? Are they military? Are they private? Where do they get their orders from?
If I may first, about my activism, I want to say first props to you, David, for having, with your work, set the established a lot of the framework in which we operate here in D.C., and everything that you've done. But with this particular incident, I mean, another member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, Jason Lemieux, who's a fellow board member, has written some great essays, which are available at ivaw.org, called Hammers Can't Fix Computers. And the reason I mention that in the context of this story is that the military can't do the job of a police force. This was during summer 2004 when fighting had flared up in Fallujah after the siege, when we had a sort of loose cordon around the city. And we got the intel that Darqawi was in the city and was fleeing in a black Opel. And they sent me and one other grunt to go stop any black oval coming past our checkpoint, which was an entry control point to our facility. But they wanted us to go out on the highway in front of us. That was the highway that went between Fallujah and Baghdad. So there's cars going by like 50, 60 miles an hour. And so when a black blur comes my way, I get up on the freeway, you know, put out my hand and say, stop. And fortunately, that particular car pulled over, you know, and well, it's not that important to the story, but you can hear the whole thing as part of my testimony if you go watch the video. The point I think that you're getting at is that later that day, we set up a proper checkpoint, or at least an impromptu vehicle checkpoint. And we found a couple guys that had a bag of cash in their back seat, you know, and it was like a small sandbag, maybe. And in dinars, it was only the equivalent of about 10,000-15,000 American dollars. With American dollars, it might have been a lot, but you know, the Marines that detained them didn't know that. It was just, yeah, it's suspicious. You know, we're going to detain them for questioning, and you know, they were handled pretty properly and politely. You know, but if you had a real police force there, you know, that was trained in that, they would be able to ask them some appropriate questions, probably right there on the spot. You know, if you had people that spoke the language, if you have translators available. As it was, we didn't even have a translator there at this point. And so, and plus that translator had to mean, if there was a translator there, he would have had to stay there on that post to maintain that, you know, to stay with the checkpoint. So I had been back in our facility, and I was called to go out and pick these two guys up. So I went out with my Humvee, we put them in the back of the Humvee, drove them into the office, and we had them sitting in the office, and we were just keeping an eye on them. And then the interrogators came. We were like, well, we have some guys that need to be questioned. What do? We call our human intelligence team. They're the humans, as we call them. This is a group of Marines that's trained in interrogation. And they're Marines. And they're trained in military interrogation. And so they come in, and they see these two guys sitting in our air-conditioned office, and they're like, why the heck are you being so nice to these guys? And so they start preparing them for interrogation. And they get blindfolded, and they get roughed up, and they get pushed against the wall, and they get shoved around. And, you know, it turns out that they were so rough with these guys that one of the officers on the outside actually reprimanded them. And, you know, I'm really glad that that happened. But it's like, it's too late. The situation makes this inevitable. Even if they had been totally appropriate and nice to these guys, the outcome probably would have been pretty similar. Because they roughed them up, they interrogated them for a couple of hours, and they determined that there was no reason to detain them whatsoever, and they let them go. And if that money was not intended for the insurgency before that incident, I'm pretty sure it wasn't afterwards.
I think that's an important point. We have a caller to the program, Mike from California. You're on the People Speak Radio with Adam Kokesh.
Hi, Adam. During the earlier part of the war, there was a website that offered free porn passes to our soldiers in Iraq in return for pics of the realities of war. I was wondering if you are aware of that, and if you know anybody that contributed. It had some really gross pictures on it, you know, like corpses and, you know, just what the face of war is, I guess. Thank you.
I don't know anybody who was involved in that program in particular, but there were a lot of trophy pictures that got passed around in Iraq, you know, thanks to the technology of laptops and thumb drives.
Adam, I would add to that if people go to afterdowningstreet.org and click on images, they can find a lot of those photos, and they are some of the most revolting trophy photos of people.
You know, I gotta caution people, especially if there's any veterans listening, and like, I can all, this is, you know, if you're gonna do that, like right now, like, there's a lot of other good stuff on afterdowningstreet.org to keep you empowered and educated and occupied. Please don't take more than a couple minutes to look at those pictures. If you're gonna like say that I want to see this side of war, set a timer or something that you know you're going to pull yourself away from, because, you know, I don't know, maybe it's just me as a veteran who has, like, you know, a really visceral connection to some of these images, but when I see that stuff sometimes, like, you know, I can't stop, you know, sometimes I'll stare at a single picture for, you know, I don't even know how long, you just, you know, I just, I just want to tell people, like, this is you know, what you're going to see, you know, is the worst of what mankind is capable of. And you don't want to dwell on that.
Very well said, Adam. People are sending us in questions to this show, as they do by email, and John in Canada asks, are you now a conscientious objector?
Well, I didn't have to be by the military definition, and, you know, I haven't gotten to the point of really examining whether or not I would qualify if I was in the military right now, but it's a great way for people who find themselves philosophically at odds with the military to go into that and to examine the conscientious objector program. And for anybody out there who's listening who wants to find out, who's considering that for themselves and wants to help with being guided through that process, please go to GIRights.org, call the hotline. You can talk to a counselor there on the GI Rights hotline, and they'll guide you through the process. And as well, it's for anybody else who's listening, who knows anybody in the military, who knows that they can use that kind of legal advice or just general advice about GI Rights, it's an excellent resource. So please share that and pass that on. But as for being a conscientious objector, I got out without going back to Iraq and never had to consider that as a way to get out of going back or of getting out of the system. But it is one of the options. And for some people, depending on their commands, they can fill out the paperwork and do the application and have all the interviews and whatnot, and they're out in a matter of months, and it's great. I know guys that have taken them over 3 years to get approved as a conscientious objector. So it's not foolproof, but if you really find yourself philosophically at odds with what the military stands for today, then it's definitely worth exploring.
Good advice. Thanks, Adam. We also have a question sent in from Sue in Massachusetts. Actually, two questions. Adam, I would like to know if the reason that you dropped out of college is because you were caught up in the emotionalism after 9/11, and if so, why didn't you do the research of the Bush lies?
Yeah, that's a good question. It is not for us to question why, it is but for us to do and die. But no, I did not. Honestly, I didn't get swept up in the 9/11, post-9/11 patriotism. Like, you know, I literally wrote patriotism, you know, on the paper, you know, when I was asked, why'd you join the Marines? You know, and you get asked, like, at every stage to be trained by someone. You know, I always said patriotism. And, like, I remember when I checked in my reserve unit, this one sergeant in the admin section, I was like, all right, so why'd you join the Marines, Kokesh? And I was like, patriotism. You know, like, you know, I'd said it 100 times, it wasn't a big deal. And he was like, what? Say it again? And he was like, hey, Corvo, come here, check this out. Hey, come here, look at this. Hey, Kokesh, tell the Corvo why you're doing the ring. You know? And he was like, no, you're kidding. You didn't join to get your teeth fixed? And it was like, no, really, like, I wanted to serve. I wanted to be part of the national defense, you know? And I don't mean to think that or say that I was alone in that, because I joined in 1999. But, you know, I like to say I joined out of patriotism before it was cool. And, you know, when I swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution, like, I knew what that meant, and I believed in it. So, to me, I saw all the post-9/11 fervor and was like, well, it's about time y'all caught up, you know. It's about time y'all, you know, show some respect for this country. It's about time, you know, like, realize what a wonderful blessing it is to be born in the United States of America in this day and age. And and it was in New York. I was in California. I didn't really get caught up in it.
Well, but you were dropping out of college, whereas a great many people are joining in hopes of getting money to go to college. So it makes it a little bit of a
right.
of a different situation.
Well, I don't know if dropped out is accurate. I know it's kind of a slang term, but I took an indefinite leave of absence.
Yes.
You know, planning on coming back.
And you have gone back.
Right. I came back and I finished my degree, and right now I'm in Washington D.C. actually getting a master's. But I hope to get back to Santa Fe when after we're done ending the war.
In the meantime, you are in D.C. doing full-time what so many people are doing part-time and others are wishing someone else would do for them, and that is being a citizen activist against this thing. I know General Petraeus is scheduled to testify very soon in the Senate and the House, and I recall being there last time he testified back in September and seeing you hauled out to jail.
I was the last one to get out of the hearing room without getting arrested.
I thought you were arrested.
No, I was lucky. I was the last one to get out of the hearing in Canning without getting arrested that day. But we, honestly, I think Petraeus, I think he's a political hack, but I think he honestly believes in what he says he believes, and I think he's caught up, he represents that part of America that is self-deluding on the reality, because they believe in that arrogance, they believe in that infallibility of America, and they believe it in their heart so much, and it hurts to give that up, But when you love something, you're able to take an honest look at it too, and get down to reality. And I don't really think it's productive at this point for us as a movement to attack Petraeus. He really is a very smart, capable man. I mean, I'm not saying that that doesn't mean that he's infallible by any means. And clearly he's making some grave mistakes, and he's made some choices for his career over doing what's right. But he's not unique in that. This country is full of people who have made similar decisions. And so what I think it's really important to say is that, we want the resources, the support that's behind Petraeus to come home. We realize that, he's doing his best. He really wants to win, but he hasn't come to the realization that you can't win a crime. You can't win an occupation. And so, at least right now, that's my feeling. That's my attitude. That, what we need to say is imagine what, we could have if Petraeus was home, fighting the war on poverty. What if he was here fighting a war on crime? What if he was here fighting a war to rebuild American infrastructure? I mean, we want to put the term fighting a war on everything, like the war on drugs, which itself needs to end, by the way. But, at least that's my attitude right now,
Well, he was there, and we were there, Adam, we were there last time, at least I was, to question his agenda and honesty, and this time, as you know, he will be making the case for Bush and Cheney for yet another $102 billion.
And like I said, I think that he's made some choices that put his career first. He's a careerist. He's a political hack. I'm comfortable saying that, but the point isn't, we don't need to attack him. Because, if anything, he's more of a puppet, a shill, and a front man for the men behind the curtain, or not so behind the curtain, in this administration. And what we need to be attacking is that ideology. We need to be attacking that attitude towards American foreign policy. We need to be attacking that arrogance. And you don't attack arrogance with counterattack of, well, we're right and you're wrong. You show your humility. You can still present a counterpoint and your basic confidence in what you believe in without necessarily attacking an individual. Hey, maybe I'm wrong. This is just my current attitude about the strategy. But I really don't feel at this point, I just don't feel like attacking Petraeus. I don't think he's that important. I think he's been elevated by this administration because, obviously, as it's been said, they're hiding behind a skirt.
Well, I at one point I certainly agree with you in that Bush and Cheney are running the show and he's working for them. I know you've got to be somewhere this evening, Adam. Why don't you
I'm sure that you and I will have a chance to sit down and discuss a little more strategy here in D.C. moving forward. But tonight I'm at a special screen of the movie Body of War, featuring another member of Iraq Veterans Against the War, Thomas Young, who's a friend of mine, an amazing man, He volunteered at on September 13th. He made the call September 13th, 2001, that I want to serve my country. He saw Bush on top of the rubble saying, we're going to smoke out the evildoers, and he wanted to help. And he volunteered, he risked his life for it, and he went to Iraq instead. And in the first week of the war, he was shot through the spine and has been living in a wheelchair ever since. And so this documentary is about his story, the true story of an anti-war hero. I mean, this guy came home and, in addition to putting his life together, after this traumatic experience and readjusting his entire life to living in a wheelchair, he's been an incredible, outspoken critic of the war and the policy of this administration. And this movie, Body of War, it was a documentary that was put together in part by Phil Donahue. I've already seen it. It's really powerful. It's opening in select theaters on the 28th, this coming Friday, and then nationwide soon thereafter. I'm sorry, I don't know exactly when it goes full nationwide, but select theaters on Friday, and I really encourage everyone to see it.
And the film is called Body of War. Do you have to leave us, Adam? Do you have time for one more question?
Yeah, no, I really got to go. The screen here is ending, and we're being asked to stand behind our brother Thomas and support him. And he's going to be speaking on a panel here. And there's more information about that on the website at IVW.org. And there's, we've been talking about the Winter Soldier testimonies, which happened on the 13th through the 16th. You know, what we did to mark the fifth anniversary, the start of the sixth year of this criminal occupation. And there's lots of great footage from that at IVW.org. And so I'd really appreciate it if people take the time to support the troops and listen to them when they come home, too.
Adam, we all appreciate very, very much everything you're doing. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, David. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And that was Adam Kokesh of IVAW, Iraq Veterans Against the War. He was one of the witnesses at the Winter Soldier hearings, which you can watch the full videos of, and it makes a tremendous event, a local event, to show these videos and discuss them. Go to IVAW.org, and he is at a premiere of the film that Phil Donahue has been working on largely since he was kicked off the air because he was expected not to wave the flag for this invasion. You can go to bodyofwar.com to find this film, and as Adam said, it will be opening around the country. The PeopleSpeakRadio.net is the show coming up next week, next Tuesday. James Colcorn and Laurentine Ten Bosch, the director and the producer of Food Matters. And next Wednesday, same time as this program, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, I will be interviewing Professor Linda Bilmes, who is the co-author, along with Joseph Stiglitz, of The $3 Trillion War. This is a careful analysis of the true costs of this invasion and occupation, simply in financial terms. So this is the other side of the picture. We've been talking about some of the human costs this evening. That'll be next Wednesday on the People Speak Radio. This is David Swanson. Thanks for being with us. Talk to you next week.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city wall by the relief of the I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you. And